Imagine trying to capture the sheer fury of a volcanic eruption.
Oh, that's a massive undertaking.
Right, but instead of meticulously drawing red magma and smoke with a tiny precise brush, you basically unleash a literal physical catastrophe directly onto your canvas.
You're just letting the elements take over.
Exactly. I mean, you pour the chemicals, you alter their densities, and then you just step back to let the laws of fluid dynamics do all the heavy lifting for you.
It's a completely different way of thinking about art.
It really is. And welcome to today's deep dive. Our mission today is to dissect the physical mechanics, and I mean the really deep emotional undercurrents of a contemporary abstract piece called Hobo.
Yeah, created in June 2021 by the artist Jarrah Duke.
Right. And we are pulling directly from his own documentation, his private studio notes, to really figure out how this thing came to life.
Because it's not a normal painting process.
No, not at all. We are looking at a painting created by explosive thermodynamics, mimicking a violent Latin American volcano. So the overarching mystery we have to solve for you today is why on earth the artist decided to name it Hobo.
Which is such a wild pivot. But, you know, that title is actually the ultimate conceptual key to the entire piece.
I can't wait to get into that.
We will get to it, but we first have to establish the physical reality of how this artwork was even born. I mean, we are exploring what happens when a creator essentially hands over the reins to natural laws.
Right.
We're looking at fluid dynamics, emotional trauma, and honestly, the deliberate destruction of the canvas's surface.
Okay, let's unpack this. Yeah. Because usually throughout art history, we celebrate the absolute dictatorship of the creator. Right?
Oh, totally. The myth of the genius controlling every stroke.
Exactly. Think of hyperrealism, where the artist is controlling every single micrometer of the canvas.
Right, like every eyelash is planned and executed with microscopic precision.
Yeah. But with this artwork, Duke is basically setting up a chemistry experiment and letting the material itself become the event.
The physical environment becomes just as important as the artist's own hands in that scenario.
Which is wild to think about.
It is. And before we can even begin to understand how the paint is moving on this canvas, we have to look at where this is happening, the scene of the crime, so to speak.
His studio.
Right. But it functions much more like a laboratory than a traditional romantic atelier. It's located in Whittier, California.
Okay.
And the arena for this chemical battle is a highly specific vertical canvas measuring exactly 30 by 15 inches.
Wait, 30 by 15? That is an incredibly tight, constrained space to unleash a fluid experiment.
Very narrow.
Yeah, if you are visualizing this with us, 30 by 15 inches is basically a vertical sliver. It forces the materials to interact aggressively because there is simply nowhere else for them to go.
And the materials themselves are engineered for that exact aggressive interaction. Duke utilizes Liquitex acrylics, but they're heavily modified with pouring mediums.
Which, for anyone who hasn't messed around with paint chemistry, what exactly is a pouring medium?
Good question. A pouring medium is a chemical additive that fundamentally alters the viscosity of the paint.
Okay.
It allows the acrylic to flow, to pool and expand autonomously across the cotton surface without losing its structural integrity.
I'm stuck on the mechanics of that for a second. If you just want paint to flow like a liquid, why not just add a bunch of water to it from the tap?
Oh, that's a common mistake.
No.
If you dilute heavy acrylic paint with too much water, you actually break down the polymer binders that hold the pigment to the canvas.
Oh, so it just ruins the paint.
Completely. The paint will literally fall apart. It loses its vibrant color, and it'll just flake off once it dries. It's a mess.
Oh, wow. So you can't just water it down.
Right. A pouring medium extends the volume and changes the fluid dynamics of the paint, making it pourable while preserving the chemical suspension of the pigment.
I see.
You are engineering the paint to behave like a fluid force of nature, maintaining its molecular strength while giving it total mobility.
That is fascinating. But having a vertical canvas in a California studio and a few jars of chemically altered Liquitex is really just the physical starting line, isn't it?
Barely even the starting line.
Because when I was reading through the artist's notes, there was one line that made me completely stop in my tracks.
Let me guess. The lack of a sketch.
Yes. It literally said, without reference image, author's design.
Yeah, that's a huge detail.
There is absolutely no physical sketch, no pencil lines on the canvas to guide the pouring.
It completely upends the traditional understanding of how a painting, especially one about a natural disaster, usually starts.
I have to admit a major blind spot here. How do you even begin a structured creative process with zero visual roadmap?
It sounds impossible, right?
It does. If you were just pouring chemically thinned paint onto a canvas without boundaries, how do you ensure it doesn't just turn into a giant muddy puddle of brown paint on the studio floor? You have to have some kind of plan.
Well, the true sketch for this painting isn't a grid on a piece of paper. The sketch is an internal emotional state.
Okay, tell me more about that.
The documentation reveals that this piece was actually born out of Duke's overwhelming, repeated exposure to news images of a highly tragic volcanic eruption in Latin America.
So he was watching this disaster unfold on the news.
Right, constantly. And the goal was never to paint a literal illustrative postcard of a smoking crater.
Because that would be too controlled.
Exactly. If you try to paint a literal picture with this pouring technique, you are still trying to exert control over the fluid.
So the trauma of witnessing that disaster from afar serves as the actual foundation of the composition.
It's the engine driving the whole thing.
It's almost like a jazz musician walking out onto a stage, sitting down at the piano without a single piece of sheet music, and relying entirely on a past emotional gut punch to drive a 20-minute improvisation.
That's a great way to put it.
The emotion dictates the energy of the performance, not a predetermined set of notes.
Exactly. The methodology here is to let the raw, chaotic energy of that trauma filter directly into the physical act of painting. Duke is essentially matching the emotional violence of a natural disaster with the physical violence of fluid dynamics. You are forcing the paint to behave like a volcano rather than just looking like one.
But trauma is just an emotion, right?
Mm.
To actually put that violence onto the canvas, Duke had to rely on something completely devoid of human emotion, which is physics.
Yes. Cold, hard physics.
Which brings us to the actual pour, where the colors in this painting are engaged in this brutal territorial dispute based purely on their physical weight.
Let's break down the mechanics of that dispute, because it is governed entirely by fluid dynamics and density.
Okay, walk me through it.
So in this specific piece, the cool colors, the blues, the grays, the stark whites, they represent the suffocating ash and the ocean water surrounding the eruption.
Got it. Water and ash are the cool colors.
Right. And chemically, because of the specific mineral compounds used to formulate those pigments, these cool colors are physically heavier.
They just weigh more.
Exactly. They possess a higher specific density than the other colors on his palette.
So when they hit the canvas, gravity is pulling them down much harder than the rest of the paint.
Yeah, they're actively sinking downward, embedding themselves deep into the weave of the cotton.
And as those heavy, cold colors sink into that highly constrained 30 by 15 inch frame, they have to displace whatever is already there.
They have no choice. There's limited real estate.
And what they displace are the warm colors.
Right.
Right? The vibrant oranges, the deep reds, the yellow ochres that represent the fire and the magma of the volcano.
Yes. Because those warm, fiery pigments are physically lighter in their molecular density.
It makes sense. If we picture this like a crowded elevator, the heavy blue paints are the big guys shoving their way in, and the lighter red paints are the people getting physically squeezed upward and pushed out of the way.
Because there simply isn't enough square footage for everyone.
Right.
So if you're visualizing the final piece, these reds and oranges literally look like pulsating embers that are trapped and suffocating beneath a heavy layer of freezing water.
Man, that's intense.
It is. The lighter colors are violently forced upward toward the surface without any mercy.
Here's where it gets really interesting. I found a direct quote from the artist in the source material that perfectly captures this dynamic. He wrote, "The painting doesn't rest, it slides."
Oh, I love that line.
Isn't it great? When you conceptualize that for a moment, you realize you are looking at a literal tectonic event playing out in real time across this tiny arena. The forces are constantly pushing, displacing, and sliding over one another.
The paint essentially acts as a river of matter desperately trying to find equilibrium.
Which it can't find.
Right, because it's constantly disrupted by the differing weights of its own components. The heavy and light pigments are fighting for territory, governed entirely by buoyancy.
So we have this sliding paint, these battling densities, the heavy blues basically crushing the lighter reds. But eventually this violent liquid motion has to stop, right?
It does. Unless he keeps adding paint forever.
Which he doesn't, so the canvas has to dry. Which introduces an entirely different branch of physics into the equation.
Right. That transition from liquid chaos to a solid state is where fluid dynamics, hands the baton over to thermodynamics.
Thermodynamics. Okay.
Amidst this raging horizontal river of paint, as it starts to dry, distinct circular structures begin to emerge across the surface.
Oh, like little bubbles.
In fluid painting, these are often referred to as cells.
Cells.
Okay.
They look almost like organic biological cells or sudden craters opening up in the paint.
Aesthetically, they introduce this incredible irregular rhythm to the composition.
Break up the flow a bit.
Yeah. But physically, they represent momentary pauses in the violent thermal avalanche. You can think of them as micro whirlpools, where the heavy and light paints have created a temporary vortex due to their density differences.
Oh, I see.
Or they are literally suspended gas bubbles trapped in the acrylic polymer as it attempts to settle.
It's like hitting the pause button on a disaster movie right as the explosion happens. You get these perfect little moments of frozen geometry trapped inside all that sliding chaos.
Which is beautiful.
It is. But the drying process itself, the thermodynamics of the paint curing in that California studio, introduces another critical concept that is fundamental to understanding this contemporary abstract methodology.
Ah, yes.
The artist refers to it as material truth.
Which is such an important concept for anyone trying to understand modern art. A lot of gallery visitors see a rough, heavily cracked canvas and immediately assume the artist made a technical mistake.
Right, like they didn't know what they were doing.
Exactly. Like they mixed their mediums incorrectly or accidentally left the piece out in the hot sun.
But in Hobo, the destruction of the surface is 100% deliberate and deeply tied to those laws of thermodynamics you mentioned.
Oh, absolutely.
I really want to dig into the how of that destruction. Because how does a smooth liquid cool of paint transform into a desolate, cavernous landscape just by sitting in a room?
It all comes down to how thick layers of acrylic polymer cure.
Okay, take me to the chemistry again.
So when the paint is sitting on the canvas, the top layer is directly exposed to the air, right? That top layer evaporates its water content really rapidly and hardens into a solid, inflexible skin.
But the paint is thick, so the layers underneath that skin are still completely liquid and wet.
Exactly. And that's where the conflict starts. As that bottom wet layer finally begins to lose its water content through evaporation, a violent physical reaction occurs.
What happens?
The acrylic polymer chains in the wet layer contract. The paint physically shrinks as it cures.
Oh, wow.
So because the bottom layer is shrinking while the top layer is already hardened and totally inflexible, the contracting bottom layer literally pulls and rips the top skin apart.
So the drying process is literally tearing the canvas to shreds from the inside out.
It's self-destruction.
That's crazy. And the resulting surface of Hobo is incredibly rough. I mean, it's full of deep, cavernous tectonic cracks and overlapping abrasive layers.
And that right there is material truth.
Okay.
The material is not trying to hide its chemical reality. It's not pretending to be a smooth, glossy, illusionary window into another world.
Like a Renaissance painting or something.
Right. The violently cracked acrylic is behaving exactly like cracked earth. It perfectly mimics the texture of instantly cooled volcanic rock after a devastating eruption.
So it's just being what it is.
The material is brutally honest about what it went through to cure.
But, you know, what does this all mean for the person actually standing in the gallery looking at it? Why purposely destroy the smooth, pristine surface of the canvas?
It changes the entire relationship with the viewer.
I think it fundamentally shifts the art from being a purely optical experience, something you just analyze visually from across the room, to a deeply tactile one.
Oh, absolutely.
Even if you aren't allowed to touch it in a gallery, your brain physically feels those cracks. The trauma of the Latin American volcano isn't just illustrated with pretty colors.
Yeah.
It is literally fossilized into the physical geography of the canvas.
Duke actually noted in his documentation that this is a painting that must be felt before it is understood.
I love that.
It bypasses the analytical part of your brain that wants to identify specific shapes or landscapes, and it goes straight to your sensory memory.
Because you just react to the texture first.
Exactly. You are reacting to the violence of the material truth before you even register the colors or the composition.
Okay, so we have decoded the physical geology of the painting.
Yeah.
We understand the thermodynamic tearing of the canvas. And we understand the emotional trauma of the Latin American volcano that sparked the initial pour.
We've covered a lot of ground.
We really have. But this brings us right back to that glaring mystery from the very beginning of our deep dive.
The title.
The title of the piece. We are talking about magma, tectonic plates, specific gravity, and a volcanic disaster.
Right.
But the painting is not named Volcano. It's not named Eruption or Magma. It is named Hobo.
Which just sounds so contradictory at first.
It really does. Historically, a hobo refers to a wandering, homeless traveler, specifically entering the cultural lexicon during the era of the American Great Depression.
Right, guys with bindles on sticks.
Yeah. It evokes images of people hopping freight trains, moving from town to town, looking for temporary work.
It's a very human narrative.
Exactly. It implies a very specific human element that seems completely, wildly disconnected from the fluid dynamics of a volcanic eruption in Latin America.
But if we connect this to the bigger picture, it is actually the most brilliant conceptual leap the artist makes in this entire process.
Okay, you need to walk me through this.
The piece, at its very core, is entirely about displacement and errancy.
Okay, displacement. How does a Great Depression traveler map onto a 30 by 15 inch canvas of cracked sliding paint?
Think about the grand metaphor of a hobo's existence. A hobo doesn't wander for fun.
Right.
They aren't a tourist on a leisurely vacation. They are forced to move by overwhelming external pressures.
It's like a sudden economic crisis.
Or extreme hunger, or a total lack of shelter. They are entirely at the mercy of their environment, constantly being pushed from one place to another without their consent.
They are in perpetual motion because they have absolutely no other choice. The environment is dictating their path.
Yes. Now compare that to the reality of a volcano. The lava doesn't ask permission to advance upon a village. It is forced outward and downward by the immense geological pressure of the earth. It is pushed into motion by massive external forces.
Oh, wow. Which brings us right back to the crowded elevator of our canvas.
Exactly. The fluid paint behaves the exact same way.
Because of the physics we talked about.
Right. Remember the battle of the densities governed by fluid mechanics? The heavy, cold blue colors bullied the warm colors?
The red and orange pigments didn't want to move, but they were physically displaced.
They were forced to slide horizontally across the canvas because the heavier atomic elements took their space.
That is so cool. The matter itself was a nomad, trapped and wandering blindly inside the wooden frame of the canvas.
The paint is the hobo.
So the art has fully emancipated itself from its original inspiration. It stopped being a sad, literal illustration of a specific Latin American tragedy.
It transcended that.
Through the unrelenting physics of the paint, it evolved into a universal concept of displacement. The paint itself was the wanderer, hitching a ride on the laws of fluid dynamics. Just like a desperate traveler hitching a ride on a freight train.
It is the perfect marriage of process and concept. The artist's trauma provided the initial spark of energy, but the physics of density and thermodynamics provided the actual journey of the nomad.
If you are visualizing this entire process with us, it is a staggering journey from start to finish. I mean, Duke took a few humble jars of Liquitex in the California laboratory studio.
Right.
He applied the emotional footprint of a distant, devastating volcano without ever sketching a single guideline.
Complete surrender.
He allowed the heavy blues to violently crush and displace the lighter reds.
Yeah.
And then he allowed the evaporation of water to physically tear the canvas apart, creating a desolate, cracked material truth that you can practically feel in your own fingertips.
The chemistry and the chaos ultimately created a masterful representation of eternal wandering. The acrylic paint truly became the hobo.
It's amazing.
And, you know, abstract art, when created under this kind of rigorous, almost scientific methodology, is far more than just a pretty decoration designed to match a living room sofa.
Oh, definitely not.
It is a raw transfer of tactile energy. It serves as physical proof of what happens when an artist steps back, removes their own ego from the equation, and forces the material to speak for itself.
It is chaos harnessed with a very deliberate physical purpose.
Absolutely. And this raises an important question, one that fundamentally changes how we might interact with abstract art going forward.
What's that?
Well, when you stand in front of a deeply moving piece of fluid art, when you are faced with all those brutal cracks and sliding chaotic colors, are you truly connecting with the artist's original trauma?
Oh.
Or is the painting merely a mirror reflecting your own internal forces and the invisible volcanoes that push you around without ever asking your permission?
Wow. That is the ultimate magic of surrendering control to the elements. Once the artist steps back, it stops being their story and it becomes yours.
Yeah.
Well, we'll leave you to ponder those invisible volcanoes the next time you find yourself standing in front of a cracked canvas. Until next time, keep diving deep.